United States Court of Appeals, in and for the Seventh Judicial Circuit. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning. Our first case is Silvernail v. America Tech, number 051535. Good morning, Mr. Shamp.
Good morning, Your Honor, and good morning, panel and audience. May I address the court then?
Yes, please.
Thank you. The appellant believes that this issue, the issue primarily before the court today, is whether a plan administrator's interpretation of its plan is contrary to the law and the intent of Congress. The appellant believes that the law requires that vesting accrual begins on the earliest date of either becoming a plan participant through benefit accrual or contributions or employment at age 22. If the plan exists.
Now, Mr. Shemp, ERISA specifically permits a plan to disregard years of service before age 22, so long as the plan otherwise meets the criteria of 10-year cliff vesting. So wasn't Ameritech perfectly entitled to disregard the years that Mr. Silvernail worked before he reached the age of 22?
We believe that the Ameritech is eligible to disregard employee years of non-participation going forward from the time they amended the plan. But if everything that you read, we believe throughout the statute says that once you become a participant, that's when you start accruing benefits. That's when you start getting your vesting rights start accruing. And so we believe that there is some vagueness in the statute as written when it uses the word employee, because it doesn't clarify really whether that says any employee, whether or not they're a participant or not. So we believe you have to go back to the intent of Congress at the time the law was passed.
But wait a minute, Mr. Shemp. If Mr. Silvernail had quit working for what was then Illinois Bell,
yes,
the day before the plan was revised in 1976 to bring it into compliance with the then-new ERISA, he would have been entitled to exactly zero as a pension, because the old plans required a longer period of working before any of his rights would be vested. There was no cliff vesting. There was nothing. Under the 1967 plan, he would have had, I think the most generous is worked 30 years regardless of age if he had gotten administrative approval. The 1969 plan would have, if he had worked 15 years, he could have gotten a pension. So the day before that plan, or the day before, if you will, ERISA was enacted, he had no right at all to, nothing was vested. Maybe things were accruing, but nothing had vested yet. And I don't see why, when Ameritech, or then whoever you want to call them, amends the plan in 1976 to become actually a more generous plan, he could have gotten benefits sooner had he met the 10-year requirement post age 22. I don't know why you see that as looking backward and changing the nature of his rights from age 18 to age 22.
Well, I think you have to look back at really what was, why was this law even passed? The law was passed because employers were doing exactly what you said. They were taking these tax-deductible contributions, they were soaking them away, they were making vesting a very long period of time, and employees were getting screwed out of their rights right and left.
That may be right, but the ERISA, like many statutes, embodies a number of legislative compromises, and you can see it in the legislative history that both you and your opponent have cited, that they do allow faster vesting. They allow even the look back to age 22, but they put a limit on it. It's a plain and simple legislative compromise, and I don't see why we're entitled in the face of the language of the statute and regulations to undo it.
Well, Your Honor, I believe what you're really saying here is that a plan today could start making contributions at age 18 and not vest the person during that period of participation until they reached age 22. I don't believe that that's accurate, Your Honor.
We have to look at Mr. Silvernail's case, and the plan was clear at the time of Mr. Silvernail's departure from Ameritech that it would not count his years of service prior to age 22. So, you know, this isn't a case where he might have had a reasonable expectation of benefits that the company subsequently tried to take away from him.
Or to put it differently, he had no vested right at the age of either 22 or, for that matter, 29 in anything. At the time they changed the plan, no rights of his had vested yet.
He was I agree with you that at that time no rights had vested yet, and that's the reason Congress passed the law that they passed, and they made it their particular emphasis, as we saw, was on the fact that when employers started making contributions, those belonged to the employee, and they wanted to set a period of time, which was 10 years.
Well, yes and no. I mean, they didn't belong to the employee until at least you had satisfied the 10-year cliff vesting.
You know, we've got another problem here, and that is that given that the terms of the plan have always been clear as to the exclusion of service before age 22, why hasn't Mr. Silvernail, why wasn't he obliged to bring suit long before now? I mean, even given all else.
Well,
we have, that's
sorry.
Just another layer of a problem.
I understand the problem, but in a pension, until he actually tries to apply and find out what his benefits are, there is no the tolling, you know, the statute of limitation doesn't kick in. So he only recently applied to find out whether he had benefits and what those benefits were. And then that's when he realized that, hey, I don't have, they're saying I don't have any benefits, even though he was under the impression that he probably did.
You mean when he stopped working there, he was under the impression that he had a vested pension?
Well, you know, I've been around a long time, and I was an employer at that time. And I know there was a lot of, when this 10-year thing came out, there was a lot of confusion. There was, you know, even among employers as to what it meant and what it didn't mean. And I think someone like him who's works at a telephone company who isn't really into plans, et cetera, he left with the idea, well, maybe I have something when I leave, but you know, I'm not going to worry about it right now. He didn't really get into this until he retired as a fireman and said, gee, I want to see what my benefits might have been or what I might have. And in reading the law, he came to the conclusion that he was entitled to benefits because he was a participant for over 10 years. And they did make contributions on his behalf for over 10 years. And I understand very clearly that reading the plan and limiting your attention to that one paragraph that's added on after the vesting section can be read that way, and it's certainly the court's prerogative to do that. But we believe that if you read throughout the rest of the act, where they refer to participation and when you become eligible, etc., and when you read through the legislative history, it's very apparent that what was meant, possibly misworded, but what was meant was that once you start accruing benefits, credits towards benefits, you also start accruing vesting credits.
I just don't see how you work the other language of the statute into that theory of what it really means. Why would Congress have bothered to put in the language about, you know, except that the following may be disregarded? A, years of service before age 22. I mean, what conceivable force do those words have under your view?
Well, I believe that Congress was looking at the revising a plan going forward.
Well, what okay? do they mean?
And they didn't. I'm sorry.
They don't. They just say in computing the period of service and so on. I mean, under your theory, I don't know why those words ever have any meaning, forward or backward.
Which, the employee words?
That you can disregard years of service before age 22. I mean, we're not supposed to just read phrases out of statutes. And I want to know what force you think they have.
Well, I believe that if you keep your look at that only and don't look at the statute as a whole.
But you have to look at this, too. I mean, you know, sure, look at the statute as a whole. It was designed to do a lot of things about pension plans, but these words have to have some meaning. How do they apply, in your view?
We believe that when a person joins a plan, the employer has the option of bringing him into the pension plan at any time along the way. Okay? And we believe as the law has stated, they can't wait any later than age 25. And Congress went and said, not only that, even if they're not making contributions, they still have to give them credit for the employment prior to age 25, between the ages of 22 and 25.
When you say even if they're not making contributions, do you mean the employee or the employer?
The employer. So a person joins the plan at age 25, but they get vesting credit at age 22. Now, we believe that vesting begins...
Go ahead.
That vesting begins at the time of participation or age 22. That's if they're an employee. And it seems so consistent with the intent of Congress and the other language in the rest of the statute. We agree that this all hinges on what do they mean by employee. So we think you have to go throughout the rest of the statute to find out, is there one meaning for employee or more than one meaning for employee? And we believe there's an employee non-participant and there's an employee participant. And the employee participant is a special category and begins to accrue vesting.
Do you want to save the rest of your time for your rebuttal?
Yes.
All right.
Thank you
very much, Mr. Shin. Mr. Sarles, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Unlike some ERISA cases, this case does not involve any difficult issues of statutory or regulatory interpretation. There are two statutory provisions at issue. They're both from the original ERISA, as enacted in the mid-70s, and they're both perfectly clear and straightforward. One says that if a plan adopts 10-year cliff vesting, it complies with the vesting requirements of ERISA. And the other says that a 10-year cliff vesting plan may disregard years prior to age 22. Now, the Ameritech plan that was enforced at the time that Mr. Silvernail left the company was a 10-year cliff vesting plan, and it disregarded years prior to age 22. So it directly tracked what ERISA authorized.
When an employee leaves the company before his pension rights vest, what does Ameritech do with the contributions it made on behalf of that employee? Do the contributions go back into some sort of general fund, or?
No, it's not done on an individual by individual basis. My understanding is that there are actuarial forecasts made in terms of the plan as a whole, And then there are audits made to see whether those forecasts were in fact met. And then the contributions and deductions and tax credits and so forth are based on what actually happens in terms of the plan as a whole, but it's not done on an individual by individual basis.
So in other words, that money stays in the plan, and actuarially there's a prediction of how high a level of contribution is necessary to meet the future obligations. This is a defined benefit plan, I assume.
Yeah, and if there were a lot of Mr. Silvernails, more than had been forecast, that would require some reversals, and it would have tax implications and so forth.
During the time that he was employed, was the company alone making contributions to his retirement benefits, or did employees also make some sort of contributions?
My understanding, and this is based on the allegations of the complaint, is that only the company was making contributions at that time.
I had a statutory interpretation question for you, Mr. Sarles. In this language of 203B of ERISA as it existed at the time, it says you can disregard years of service before age 22, except that in the case of a plan which does not satisfy subparagraph A or B, and that's respectively cliff vesting and the 515 plan. Does that mean that that the plan has to have both of those options, or is it enough, as you read this, for the plan to have either one of those options?
Either one, and that's made clear in Section 203A2, when it says that the plan satisfies ERISA by either A, B, or C. And what this provision is saying is that the pre-age 22 exclusion applies only to the first two. It does not apply to the rule of 45 plans, which I understand there aren't very many of, but that was an option.
So was the Ameritech plan, I guess I'll just call it that, the Illinois Bell plan or the Ameritech plan, one that had only the cliff vesting, or was there a 515 option in it as well?
No, it had only the cliff vesting. It adopted the 10-year cliff vesting. And, of course, Mr. Sylvan worked less than 7.5 years after turning age 22, So he had no vested benefits, because the whole idea of cliff vesting is that there's no graduated scale. You don't have any vesting until you hit that 10-year mark, and then you're 100% vested. So when he left, he forfeited any right to a pension plan, and then he came back 20 years later and demanded a pension. And his primary argument seems to be, it's not one of statutory interpretation, but a fairness. He's saying that, gee, it's just unfair that this retroactive harmed him. But even if that could overcome the words of the statute, the fact is that, as Judge Wood was pointing out, the changes in the Ameritech plan in 1976 actually helped him. He could have fully vested if he had stayed at the company for another 2.5 years. Under the prior plan, he would have had to stay another 10.5 years. So the change in 1976 put him to the good by 8 years, and so any notion of retroactive harm really has no application here. Counsel tried to rewrite the statute as reading participation or age 22, but of course that's not what the statute says. It says age 22. Now the court doesn't need to look beyond these two statutory provisions and the undisputed facts in order to resolve this case, but counsel raised legislative history, and just briefly, legislative history confirms that what the statute says is exactly what Congress intended, because this was a carefully crafted compromise between the Senate and the House, and it represented a balancing. I mean, this was a huge new regulatory program that employers now faced, and by eliminating the most transient part of the workforce, Congress relieved some of those burdens, because the young workers are less likely to stick around and have their benefits get vested or to retire. Now, there are two ways that the court could affirm here, either affirm on the ground that the district court did, that Mr. Silvernail failed to state a claim, or on the grounds that he lacked standing, which some of the prior decisions of this court have ruled on that basis, when a claimant did not qualify as a participant. Under the definitions in ERISA, to be a participant, a former employee must have a colorable claim. That's what the Supreme Court held in what's the case? Well, The case name is escaping me. It's in our brief. He does not have a colorable claim because of the plain statutory language. Therefore, he's not a participant, and therefore he lacks standing.
But don't you think the Supreme Court was really talking about things that really fail the Bell versus Hood test, something that's so frivolous it doesn't really engage federal jurisdiction? Mm-hmm. I mean, it amounts to about the same thing. It's a merits determination. It's not like he's somebody who never worked for Illinois Bell and is suddenly coming and knocking on the door. Maybe he was an independent contractor and says, I should have been under the plan. Whether he wins or loses, it's hard for me to say that he was so far removed from participants that standing is the way one ought to go.
Well, that's fine. I mean, it comes out the same way. And to reach the standing issue, you have to go through the merits in order to determine that it's not a colorable claim. We think it is a frivolous claim based on the clear language of the statute, and so that is a possible route. And then an alternative argument was, as Judge Rovner raised, the statute of limitations. He knew or should have known at the time that these amendments were passed in 76 and then readopted in 78 that the years prior to age 22 were excluded. And if he felt that that was contrary to ERISA, he had 5 years to bring a claim. Instead, he took a quarter century.
But, our cases speak of getting a clear and unequivocal repudiation of your rights. And that is normally from somebody with authority to speak for the plan. So some casual hallway conversation with a supervisor, pro or con, actually, is usually not enough. And he doesn't get that clear rejection until 1999 when he's approaching the age when he's hoping he might get something from this plan. So isn't it at least consistent with our prior cases to look to that moment when he gets the official word from the plan administrators, no, you don't qualify?
Well, actually, no, Your Honor, because those prior cases dealt with what are essentially breach of contract situations where somebody's arguing that they were denied benefits contrary to the terms of the plan, that the administrator misconstrued the plan or just didn't follow it. Here, what Mr. Silvernail's claim is he's not, in fact, he says on page 12 of his brief, plaintiff doesn't claim that the plan administrator violated the terms of the pension plan. What he's claiming is that the terms of the pension plan violated ERISA, and he knew or should have known that, an attorney that he would have might have consulted should have explained to him that in 1976 or 1978, when the terms of the plan were distributed to the employees.
But why is it reasonable, since even if he had qualified for cliff vesting, he wouldn't have gotten payments until he reached the age of 65, right? I mean, you're vested, but then there's this long period of time between when you vest and when you start getting payments. So I'm having trouble thinking that this is such an unreasonable time for him to look into it.
Well, it's whether we may feel it's reasonable or unreasonable. The question is, when did his claim accrue, which is when he knew or should have known that there was a violation of ERISA in the sense of the terms of the plan?
You know, any time we deal with ERISA, we're dealing with Alice in Wonderland. And even the lawyers are dealing with Alice in Wonderland. So to expect Mr. Silvernail to understand the vagaries of this particular statute is really a very heavy burden.
Well, you know, let me just remind the court that there's no need to reach the statute of limitations issue because the statutory language is so clear, but it is an alternative ground, and we think a quarter of century is unreasonable for any plaintiff and would defeat the purpose of statute of limitations to allow someone to take that long. Finally, let me just say a word about his second claim, which wasn't mentioned this morning.
The district court didn't mention it either. That's
no,
a little troublesome.
That's true. And ideally, the district court should have said something about it. But in defense of the district court, based on the initial ruling, he had no benefits. And there's nothing in ERISA that requires a statement of benefits to someone who has no benefits.
Yes, but, you know, I wondered about that as well. I mean, you know, they say that maybe over the telephone they're saying, you know, you don't have any benefits, whatever. But for heaven's sakes, the piece of paper, you have
Well, he got many pieces of paper telling him he had no benefits. His complaint itself says that he was denied administratively and then denied in an administrative appeal, and both of those documents explained the age 22 exclusion and so forth. So he got a statement that he had no benefits, and each time he wrote to the company, they responded in the same way. And as far as the statutory provision here, it's 29 U.S.C. 1025A2. And first of all, you have to be a plan participant. But even if you could get over that hump, it says that if you request in writing a statement indicating the non-forfeitable pension benefits, if any, which have accrued. So if there are not any, you don't have to get some sort of formal statement that's labeled statement of benefits. He did receive multiple
times.
Wouldn't
it save you all a lot of trouble? We're done.
Well, the documents that he appended to his district court brief shows that it was done, but I'm trying to argue this in such a way that you don't necessarily have to look at those documents since we're on a motion to dismiss. And in fact, he says in his complaint that he received in writing at the administrative level explanations as to why he had no benefits. And that constitutes a statement of benefits, at least as a technical matter. But as a matter of fact, he did receive statements each time he requested some sort of clarification as to why he was not getting any pension. So if there are no further questions, that's basically our position.
Thank you very much, Mr. Saul. Okay. Mr. Shem, how much time?
5 minutes.
Two.
Two?
Yeah.
Oh,
when the white light went on, rebuttal time started.
I misused my time. I would say, though, that if you did go back to the committee report, which we referenced, it clearly states that once benefit accrual starts, vesting starts. That was the intent of Congress, and we have that committee report 93-1280 referenced in our brief. Also, the federal regulations makes a lot of emphasis on participation and basically says, gee, if you can't tell if he's participating or not, he's participating, because it's such an important part of the rights of the member of the plan. And the other thing I'd clarify is that he was supposed to get a statement of accrued benefits, even though they may not have been vested. And I think if we go back, and I don't have the citations right now, he should have gotten that. They eventually did give it to him, but it took a long time. Finally,
when you say that, did he get a statement, sort of a hypothetical statement, if you had stayed, this is how much we contributed
behalf? Yeah, he got something, as I remember, that said this is approximately what you would have accrued. One last thing. Interpretation of the plan, that's what we're arguing. Not that the plan is illegal, but the way they're interpreting the plan would not conform to what the law was intended to be.
Thank you very much.
Thank you
to both counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.